This is FNX.
Listen to Shoot the Defense. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello, welcome to a special edition of Shoot the Defense on FNX. I'm your host, Del, and I'm joined by Netan Sensara from Norwegian side Hud. Netan, how you doing, Geezer? You all right?
Yeah, mate, not bad. All good. Enjoying pre-season, so yeah, all good, mate.
Excellent, excellent. And how's your training session today?
Yeah, it's all good, mate. We had a game on the weekend, so yesterday we had, Saturday we had a game, Sunday we had off, and then we just trained today, so yeah, just resting up now after training and... yeah, getting ready for the week ahead.
Last time we spoke, you were in Turkey for a pre-season tour, I believe. Was that more like a warm weather training kind of thing, or?
Yeah, I think so. It's more kind of like, you know, obviously here in Scandinavia, especially Norway where I am now, the winter months are probably, you know, you get a long pre-season from January to April. So, you know, the lads have been stuck in the snow for a long period of time. So it's good to get out into some warm weather and, you know, get on some grass as well and get some team bonding and obviously play some games as well. So it works out well, to be fair.
Is it a bit frustrating, the length of time that you guys have for pre-season? Because you obviously want to be kicking the ball from a competitive standpoint.
Yeah, I think so. I think the biggest thing for me, especially now I've got a bit older, is, knowing your body and, maintaining that kind of balance of, you know, being fit but not overdoing it. You know, because you think to yourself, if you go all out in January, you still got three months to the season start. So it's about maintaining, and I'm used to it now, so I know that, you know, when I come back after Christmas, you don't have to be flying into, you know, training sessions, because you know that, you know, the season, you know, the carrot at the end of it is the first game of the season.
Excellent, excellent. Well, mate, before we talk about your career, tell me a bit about your background.
Yeah, I have parents. My grandparents are born from born in India, from a Sikh community. You know, my grandfather came over from Punjab in India in the 70s. Kind of paved the way for us, really. So I'm grateful that he came over and, you know, had a few businesses and did well for himself. And then obviously, you know, that's my father's dad. He came over, done well for himself, and then obviously, you know, left the platform for his sons, which were my uncles, to kind of have a good life, you know, because it's a contrast to being in India and being in England. So we're forever thankful for the sacrifices these people made for us.
Mm. And I'm sure you've heard a lot of stories about your family when they came over to the UK. Are there any ones that really stand out in your mind?
Yeah, I think the biggest one for me is I'll speak about my father's dad, just because he was like one of the first Indian guys to have a pub in the West Midlands area. So he went in that trade. To be fair, he's the first one, one of the first ones to have a pub in the West Midlands. So it was that was pretty. You know, that sticks out a lot because obviously the Asian community in those days, didn't really have a place where they would go and socialize and, you know, have a drink and, you know, because predominantly being, a white working class thing to do. So obviously the people in the factories, the Indians, the locals that would work in the, you know, the local steelworks and stuff, they would obviously find that as a place to socialize. And the people would come from as far as Coventry, etc., just to go to that one pub. So that's a story that sticks out, you know, and I think that's where my dad and my uncles and stuff get that kind of football mentality from as well, because they've obviously grew up around British blokes who, you know, watch football and drink beer and etc.
Now, mate, I understand you started kicking a ball about at a competitive level when you were 9 or 10. I think becoming a pro footballer is a dream for most kids at that age. So was this something you always wanted to do, or was there another career path perhaps you wanted to pursue during secondary school?
I think it was, I was pretty, pretty much of a late bloomer in terms of, you know, I didn't join an academy and such till I was 15. So it was more a sense of, obviously coming from an Asian background, British Asian background, you know, the importance of education is probably a stereotype that is stuck with Asian people, you know, throughout their lives. But it's actually pretty true that, you know, my parents were obviously drilled into me that the importance of education, you know, my mom is educated, my dad isn't, he's more, you know, found his way. But yeah, so they kind of instilled the importance of education, you know, wanting me to go to university, wanting me to you know, do something professional in my life. But at the same time, they knew that, you know, football was, you know, once it got serious at the age of like 14, 15, you know, they made sure that still, they followed, let me follow my dream, you know, but they made sure that even in my first professional contract that it was written that I was able it was important for them that I got released to go to college 3 days a week to make sure that I finished my A-levels. So I did that as well.
Mate, coming from an ethnic background myself, I know how important education is to the culture, although a lot of it is probably more for parents to kind of brag about their children's achievements to other family members. I mean, I'm sure you see, I know it's happened with my family, you know, they get together and it's always, oh, my daughter's going to university, my daughter's or my son's doing this and that. So were you kind of ever told you'll never make it as a footballer by any family members?
Yeah, I mean, it was... kind of frowned upon now, like, you know, there's only the close people that really know that I make a living from it. You know, you go to family parties, you go to Indian weddings and stuff, you say, yeah, so what does your son do? He plays football. Okay, so what else does he do then? You know, they don't have that, you know, they don't have that kind of knowledge of you know, you make a career from it. Obviously I think now, after, you know, nearly, I'm almost 30 now, I'm 29. After been doing it so long, since I was 16, now they kind of get a gist of, obviously, you know, I'm never in England, I'm never at family events, so obviously they know that I'm away working, doing my thing with football. So it's culturally, it's not really something that, you know, is a really a job title as such. You know, you don't associate Asian people with it, so they don't really see it as a job, if that makes sense.
Well, the thing is, you played in numerous countries. So is this something that you've discussed with your teammates, so to speak? Because it might be a bit unfair for me to say that it's more of a cultural thing than a generational thing. Because I think the older generation, like grandparents and whatnot, and perhaps parents maybe right now that are in their 50s, 60s, they probably still see football as not a career. Maybe it's just a pipe dream, so to speak.
I think people over in Norway, they appreciate it a lot more. Because obviously the old school kind of Norwegians, they're big fans of obviously Leeds United, you know, Liverpool, Man United. It's actually a quite diverse supporter group over here. You know, you got people supporting Stock. I've heard things like people support Stockport. People support, Northampton. Just weird, random stuff. And I think they appreciate more. People over here appreciate. If I say, tell them, you know, I've played 28 games in League One, 27 games in League One, you know, they find that as a, you know, an amazing, you know, achievement. Some of them, obviously, the younger ones don't. They don't. They think like League One is a pub league as such. But for me, you know, I know how tough it is to go out to play in League One and to have that on your CV, regardless of how many games it was. I think it's an achievement in itself. So. I think it's a bit different over here, to be fair.
Well, let's go back to your school days then. How did you get on in your GCSEs?
I've done well, mate. I think I passed everything above C grade, so I did okay. And then obviously that spiralled onto my making sure that I kind of did my A-levels as such. And then now I've just started to... I'm in the final year of my bachelor's, which I started a bit later. Okay. I started at 27. I wish I would have started earlier, to be fair, but I think, you know, when you're you know, playing week in, week out, you know, you have a lifestyle as such, you don't think about the importance of an education. But now, after when I met my missus, she has 2 degrees, and then she said to me, you know, you have to make sure that you have something, you know, ready for you. And I found a kind of course that I do through the Norwegian Football Federation, which is an online course in English, international course, in sport management bachelor. So I do that now in my final year. So it's gone well. I've enjoyed it, and yeah, it just gives me another string to my bow, as they say.
Of course. I mean, you know, we know loads of ex-footballers have gone on to get really decent jobs. I know Daniel Nardiello is a good friend of the show. He used to play for United and all them, and he's a financial advisor now. So,
yeah,
you know, it's proof that you don't... Okay, you can play... use football as a career, but it doesn't stop you from progressing in terms of an academic perspective. What did you choose for your options, by the way, at GCSEs? Because when I was young, I wanted to be a journalist. I took French and German, and I still kind of remember my German more than my French, really.
Okay, that's good. I can't remember anything about school, French, stuff like that. But we had a choice, to be fair. It was pretty good. We had a choice between PE and French, so it was only one that I was going to choose. So, I have fond memories of school. It was good, man. It was good. I wish sometimes that when I'm having a bit of, like, when I'm catching up with friends, I don't really speak to anyone from school and stuff now. But when I think back and look back and think how lucky we was to have a, you know, to grow up and, you know, have a good school life. And, you know, funny enough, I actually, every time I go back to England, usually over this Christmas period, I go to the local gym there and I still meet one of my teachers, PE teacher, actually. And, you know, I always say to him, every time I meet him, I say, you know what, I wish I could go back to them days because they were good times. Like, I'm happy and content with my life now. But, you know, when you look back and I have real, real fond memories of growing up and so lucky to have, you know, experienced, you know, good times, because not everyone's been so lucky. So, yeah, I'm very thankful of the way I was brought up.
Fantastic. So you went to college. So which course did you study?
So basically what happened was after I left secondary school, my dad, I was just ready to go to sixth form and, go down that route. Like you say, the old school kind of, you know, Indian mentality, you know, go sixth form, go university, et cetera, et cetera. And then my dad, like, he was persistent on this thing that he's seen advertised somewhere, that, you know, this football, you know, these football schools, these sports schools that they do now, where you can, you know, Birmingham City was sponsoring it at the time.
Okay.
It was kind of like a college football where you go to play football in the morning, and you would do your college in the afternoon, and you had to go for trials for it. And I was like, my dad was persistent. He was like, I think it's good for you. You know, you have a chance of making it as a footballer as well. And obviously, prior to this course, it was a new course. No one was, no one had ever gone on to do something. You know, I met with the course coordinator at the time. She was a great woman. Her name is Louise Macy. I still kind of keep in contact with her now. It was just a 2-year course. And within the first year, I'd done well in my school. It was on the side, you do like a BTEC in sport. So it's equivalent to 3 A-levels. So I did that.
Excellent, wonderful. And I believe you played for your college team as well, right?
Yeah, so obviously it was connected. So you had like a college team that you would play for, which was obviously, they had coaches that were, you know, on the kind of staff of Birmingham City, and they would coach us, and we'd train at the Birmingham City's, the Wasbills training ground, Pershore Road, just off Pershore Road in Birmingham. So it was kind of a professional setup, really. And I was probably, I think I was the first one from the course to go on and sign a professional contract. They had links through, you know, a few people here and there. And I got a trial at Walsall, and then I was signed, and then that was it.
Fantastic. So, were you actually invited to train with Walsall?
Yeah, so basically I went there to train with the YTs. After a couple of days, Nick Housel at the time, head of recruitment, just sat down with me and said, yeah, we'd like to give you a contract as a, you know, as a YT. I said, yeah, no problem. And within 3-4 months of that, I'd signed my first pro contract. So it all happened really quickly. And that's how it went.
So you made 27 appearances at Walsall. So
yeah,
how would you describe your time there, and what are your standout moments?
I think obviously making my debut, that was pretty special, obviously, and winning the game away at Yeovil. But also, obviously, at the time I was playing in the as a YT, regular in the reserves. I got called up for the England under 18s, which was pretty special to me. Being from a small club like Warsaw, to be called up and being at teams with players such as Daniel Sturridge, he was obviously my age group at that time, and he was obviously one of the main players. And Scott Sinclair also, players like this, you know. And that was a big. Big thing for me that stands out. Fun memories, you know. Making any club that gives you your debut, you should forever be thankful. I still feel like when I look back now, I still feel like I didn't give myself the best opportunity to excel. I think I could have done more, maybe. But you know that with age and with time, you reflect and you always think that you can go and do. Should have done this and you should have done that, but like I said, I'm content with what I've done now. And you know, I remember Mick Housel always used to say to us YTs, he always used to say, if you've stayed in the game after 25, then you've done okay. So I'm 29 now, and I still have his words in the back of my head, and you know, I'm thankful every day for what I have. So you know, I keep going, and when I've had enough, I can just say I've had enough. I'm content with everything I've done.
How do you mean when you said you could have done more? Do you think it's more of applying yourself more or something else?
Yeah, probably. I think, you know, being a local lad, living 15 minutes away from the training ground, living at home with my parents, I think I took everything for granted.
Right.
You know, I could have trained more probably. I could have, you know, done extra. I could have, you know, dedicated myself more. I think, like now, if you look at me now as a person, and then, you know, and now I'm the first one into training, I'm the last one out. And you know, after I left Walsall and I had to you know, go abroad for an opportunity, I think that's when the penny dropped for me. And you know, I thought to myself, okay, now I have to start to look after myself, look after my body, you know, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like now I have the mentality to what I should have had. If I would have had this mentality back then, I think I would have gone on to have a good career in England.
Fair enough. Well, I'm glad you mentioned going abroad. That's a fantastic segue to my next question. Fast forward to 2011 and you moved to Cyprus, an island which I know very well, or Lagadamia to be precise. Now,
Bayak
is located close to the border that divides the island. So
did
anyone talk to you about the north-south divide?
No, to be fair, but I remember that we used to go there for a good kebab after training sessions sometimes. And
Wait. Did you have a kebab or did you have souvlaki?
Yeah, maybe it's black. Yeah, exactly. But it was really, I remember we used to go there, and when we crossed the border, it was just surreal. Like, you know, it was just weird. You just walk over, you know. It was so weird. It wasn't really any checkpoints or anything as such. You didn't need a passport or anything. You just walk over, and, you know, there's markets and stuff on the border. And it used to be nice, you know, just to walk around, get a coffee, and... yeah, enjoy it. But no one ever really told me the history behind it until I obviously researched myself. It was good times. It's an eye opener when you go from England and you go over there and you see how it is, and it's a surreal. Put it this way, it made me appreciate and made me grow up real fast, because I'd never been away from my parents or from Warsaw at that time. But then as soon as I went over there and I had to fend for myself, that's when I knew that, okay, if I'm going to make something of my career, then I have to, you know, fend for myself and change my mentality. And I'm grateful that I went there, because after that, then I knew that, you know, you have to go out there and fight every day.
So do you think that move actually helped with your development?
Yeah, 100%. You know, if I would have gone to the conference and I remember at the time I had an offer to go to the conference. I had an offer to go trial in a League Two club, but I just remember saying, "No, I'm going to take this and go abroad." So I just went abroad, and it opened my eyes, mate. Really did, and it was a real good experience.
Mm. Now, I know English was a second language out there, and now it's Russian, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, there's about 10,000-15,000 Russians out there, but that's mostly because of the political, I should say, relationship between Cyprus and Russia. But I'm not going to go into that. Did this make this easier for you to adapt? Because I know that when I go out there, obviously I speak Greek, but for some reason they look at me and they talk to me in English despite me speaking to them in Greek. I don't know. Maybe they don't like my Greek and they're just trying to be polite. I don't know.
No, mate, it was no problem. The language barrier was real easy. And also, there was a lot of, at that time, you know, a lot of Portuguese players were playing in the Cypriot League. I think they still do, actually. And we had a lot of Cypriot Portuguese guys in our team. So English was, and they were pretty bad in English as well, but English was kind of the base language of everything and everyone. So it was pretty easy to grasp. Obviously, the biggest things I can take away from it was, you know, it's a different culture, mate. They drink a lot of frappes, as you probably know. Yeah. Mate, they love it. For every, I remember they drink like coffee with so much sugar in there. You know, smoking in the changing rooms was pretty normal. Yeah. I was like the as we call him, the president would come in smoking a fag just before a game, and the whole changing room, you know, over there, mate. There's no, in those facilities, there's no AC in the changing rooms or anything like that. It was just like, you know, I remember just thinking, whoa, is this like normal? Like, he'd come in smoking a big cigar and the whole changing room was just full of smoke. But no, it was good times, and people were good there. You know, I remember a lot of people in Cypriot football, in Greek football, they were talking about not getting paid, and, you know, they get paid late and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So many stories, but we actually had a good owner. And to be fair, over there, they appreciate people that want to work hard and want to, you know, fight. And if they see that, they love you. And that kind of was, I was lucky enough to have an owner that really, really liked the way I play. And, you know, he was good to me and he treated me very well. So I was lucky.
You know, I've heard so many horror stories from Cyprus, obviously knowing the league as well as I do. You know, there's been stories where certain teams' owners have, you know, taken the prize money from European games and just walked off and never to be seen again, kind of thing.
Yeah,
And I'm sure you've seen and heard some strange, shall we say, stories, or even seen some bizarre refereeing decisions which are quite questionable. But yeah, I mean, did you notice any major cultural differences? And by that, I mean from the culture that you're used to from your family side.
I think it was pretty, the good thing was, I think, If you take Cypriot people, I think they're very much family orientated themselves, so that I could relate to as such. But I mean, in terms of the football, it was a weird, like, people ask me all the time, how was the culture in the football sense? I think it's, the best way to explain it is it's very slow. Mm. Obviously, because it's hot as well. It's a lot slower than here in Scandinavia or in England, you know, a lot more kind of get the ball down and play kind of thing. So that was the biggest things I took away from the culture. I mean, they're very family orientated people, and you know, I could relate to that, obviously being from an Indian culture. So it was pretty good experience in terms of what I seen out there.
Excellent. Well, tell me about your experience in Denmark with Vesterland.
Well, how can I explain that? It was a first time in Scandinavia, and it was a great learning curve for me. I didn't play as much as I wanted to. I think the manager didn't trust me. But you being a young lad coming from, you know, going after 1 year in Cyprus, coming to Denmark, I think as a young English boy, I felt they thought I was a bit young, but I felt I was ready. But it was a great experience, great culture in the club, great football. Obviously went up that year, so, you know, I didn't really have a case knocking on the gaffer's door saying I should be playing when the team's winning every week. No, it was a great experience for me. And that kind of really opened my mind for playing in Scandinavia, because then I just fell in love with Scandinavia as a continent. And, you know, it's a great, great place to live.
You spent a couple of years in Norway with Fredrikstad and even captained the team. So how did it feel to put on the captain's armband week in, week out, knowing that you weren't a local lad and I assume weren't fluent in Norwegian?
No, that was pretty surreal. I remember I was voted by the players as well, so it was a big thing. And And to be fair, you know, being an Indian lad and being English, you know, I don't know if people were really, really happy about it. I don't know. You'd have to ask them. But, you know, I think my performances warranted me getting the captain's armband. I think that's what it was down to be fair. And now I live there, actually. That's where my missus is from there. I met her when I was playing there. We get married in July.
Congratulations. I live
there now. Cheers, mate. I'm building a house there. Nice. At the moment, I'm in the process of that, and it's been a great city to me. I love the city. I actually live there now, it was a great three and a half, 4 years there. Enjoyed my time there. I live there now, like I say, so it's a great place. And I have to say that now, obviously, because my missus is from there as well. So, but no, it's a really nice place, and. That's why I fell in love with the city and the lifestyle, and so that's home now.
Well, another transfer followed when FC Edmonton in Canada came calling. Now, I guess it was an easy decision to make from a career perspective, given the club were competing in the NASL with the likes of Indy 11, Miami FC, and even the New York Cosmos.
Yeah, mate, what an experience that was. It was... When I had the opportunity to go, I was a bit sceptical. You know, I just played 3 years in Europe. I was thinking to myself, I want to stay in Europe. Europe is the best place. And by the way, Europe is the best place to play football. Don't let anybody fool you. The US is a great country. Canada is a great country. But Europe is the hub of football. And anyone that wants to argue with me about that, they can. But I, after experiencing it, I just want to let people know that Europe, if you can stay in Europe, you should stay as long as you can. But what an experience it was, traveling, playing in unbelievable cities, San Francisco, New York, Miami, you know, and just to experience it, it was absolutely incredible. Living in Canada also, great country, but, you know, Europe is home to me, and I'm so happy to be back playing in Europe.
Don't blame me, mate. Well, look, just a little bit off topic here. How do you feel about the inception of the Canadian Premier League, which is starting, I believe, next month?
Yeah, great. I think it's great for Canadian people. Obviously, over the years, I've played with a few Canadians. I have a family in Canada. And I think it's great for them. Obviously, you know, if they have to play in the US leagues, there's a lot of travelling. There's still a lot of travelling in Canada because it's a massive country. But in terms of nurturing Canadian football, making it grow, I think it's great for the local Canadian people. I think it's good that they have a league. Just to kind of have a pedestal to showcase. Okay, you know, because they've always been in the shadow as such of the US. So I think it's good for them to be able to, you know, go in their own direction and kind of, you know, create a buzz in Canada.
I think it's a very bold move for them to do that, given the fact that the likes of Toronto, you know, Montreal, they've all gone to MLS. Their franchises have gone to Major League Soccer. So to create a league, you know, primarily for Canadian fans, and let's be real, I mean, there's thousands upon thousands of soccer fans in Canada, and I'm pretty sure that it will be a success. And, you know, knowing Michael Finley, who's working for the CPL and used to coach the Canadian national team, he's very, very excited about it, and I'm sure many people are there. So, yeah, I really hope it does well for him. But let's go back to FC Edmonton when you were playing there. I know there were a few players in Northern Ireland, or should I say a few players from Northern Ireland in that squad at the time. So you must have felt kind of at home, no?
Yeah, and the gaffer was Scottish as well. Like, he's Scottish-Canadian, so he was pretty... And that's what... To be fair, the only reason I don't, you know, give it as much credit as I should is because I injured my back when I was there, so I didn't really... I really went through a traumatic time with my... I herniated a disc in my back, so I was in agony, and I didn't get the right treatment that I should have. So I was a bit pissed off about that, to be fair. And that's why I'm a bit bitter towards my time there, because I felt like I could have done so much more. But the lads there were great. I mean, we had Dean Shields, who's played for Rangers and Hibs and wherever else he has. good lad, Albert Watson, Daryl Fordyce, and then yeah, and then Scottish Gaffer as well, and we had Tommy Amiobi, the brother of Shola Amiobi. So we had some good players, mate, and I think the mentality actually was kind of that British culture there, so it was easy to adapt. So the only reason I don't speak about my time very fondly there is because, I was a regular for the first 15 games, and then my back, I had a problem with that, and it was just agony, mate, for the last 6 months there. So that's why I have a kind of, it's a kind of sad time, to be fair.
Fair enough. Well, I know you returned to Scandinavia with a second division Swedish side. How did your year at the club go?
Yeah, it was okay, mate. I enjoyed it. But my kind of heart was always set on coming back to Norway. Obviously, building a house, settling down, getting married in the summer. I just wanted to get back into Norway. My citizenship kind of situation as well. I know it doesn't, obviously now with Brexit, you don't know what's happening, but I know that when I marry my missus, obviously I'm accustomed to being here in Norway, but I just wanted to make sure that everything is falling in place now. I'm getting to 30 years old. I want to kind of plan for the future as well. This is where I want to live. This is where I want to make contacts. This is where I want to kind of, make a living. So that's kind of all stemmed into my decision to kind of come back to Norway. And that's where I am now. And and I'm back with an old friend of mine, another English guy, Robin Schutt. Don't know if you know him. He's here as well now.
Okay.
He played in Stevenage, Birmingham City. He played in Nashville last year. He'll be good to have on your show, actually. He's a good lad.
Sounds good.
Yeah, so he's done well. He come from non-league. I think he came from Wimbledon. So he went through the non-league kind of, and then signed for Blues, and then played in Stevenage, Cheltenham, etc. So he's here now with me. He's one of the, he's played here before. And then he went out to Nashville again. So he's one of the reasons I'm here.
Is that Nashville's in the team in the USL?
Yeah, exactly, with the English gaffer. Because I think the gaffer from there, Stevenage, was at Stevenage with Robin, so I think they knew each other. So he's a good lad, to be fair. We've kept in contact. We played together at Warsaw for a bit. He came on loan from Birmingham City at the time. So he's one of the reasons I was here. I came here because he told me about the place, and he's lived here for 4 years prior to me being here. So. So I'm here now. I'm obviously not living in Fredrikstad. I'm an hour and a half plane's journey away. But I'm back in Norway. I know Norway. I know the culture. I understand how people live here, how it is. So it's easier for me to adapt and enjoy my football again.
Fair enough. Well, just one more thing from your career perspective. Are you planning on taking the coaching route when you eventually retire? And if so, do you think it'll be easier to find a role in Scandinavia or the UK?
I have this question all the time. And to be fair, I'm not really a coaching type. You never say never. But Shruti, Robin, I have obviously here with me, Zesh Rayman. I do the same course with him. He's done his A license. Zesh has, he's playing out in Hong Kong at the moment. He's played, obviously, captain QPR, Bradford, etc., etc.
Fulham as well. Was he at Fulham?
Yeah, Fulham. Yeah, exactly. That's him. Yeah. So he's gone down that route. But I'm more of a with my kind of academic background. I'd prefer to be like a sports director, something like that. Or like a marketing director, kind of like working as a director, really. That's kind of more my interest. How can we bring investment into a football club? How can we maybe player logistics, maybe the economy side of things, maybe bringing sponsors in. That kind of interests me. How we can make the football club evolve, how we can, help maintain, how we can, increase revenue. That's the kind of role I would like to go down.
Why do you think Norwegian clubs or even Scandinavian clubs don't have as much financial clout as most European teams? I know it's an obvious answer because obviously the commercial value and the TV money and all that kind of stuff, but we've seen so many fantastic players come from Scandinavia, but yet you're only going to see the likes of maybe Rosenborg or at a push, Brøndby. I can't remember who, which other Scandinavian, maybe Gothenburg.
Copenhagen,
yeah, Gothenburg. You know, I remember they had Jesper Blomqvist and Thomas Ravelli in goal back then. So, you know, I don't see why they don't utilise, you know, their history and all the players that played in the past and use that as some kind of vehicle to gain some kind of commercial value. I don't know.
I think after living here so long, you know, people will say, you know, Sweden, Norway, when you compare it to England, you know, you want a bottle of milk from the shop, you know, you're paying £3.50, £4.
Wow.
But this is what I try to tell people, you know, that the quality of life here, the average wage, you know, jobs, etc., you know, they pay higher salaries. So I think it's people over here as well. In 2005, you know, people, the salaries players were earning here were absolutely probably like double, triple, quadruple what players earn now. But I think in these kind of countries, they're such, you know, and they have a lot of money in these countries, a lot of oil that comes from Norway, you know, and Scandinavia. So, but I just think it's more kind of fan bases you know, again, you know, if you're getting like, you have your Rosenborgs, you have your Brand, you have, you know, a few others, but, you know, the attendances, etc. People have so many different interests here. There's skiing, there's, you know, so much other stuff. And I think that has a big effect to play on the economy side of football.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be fair, I am really impressed with their scouting system, though, because you do see a lot of African footballers playing their trade out there. And, you know, you see the likes of Obi Mikel, for example, who obviously went to United and then changed his mind and went to Chelsea.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of players. I remember there was one that was at Michelin, then ended up at Celta Vigo. So you do see a very good scouting system. So the focus on development and nurturing talent, and obviously the moneyball effect is helping these clubs stay afloat, I presume.
I think that's what I will say is it's a great opportunity for players to come. And now you can see, I think, when I came to Norway, I don't think there was many English players coming, but slowly, there's a few creeping through now into Scandinavia. You know, you have Raul Morrison in Östersund.
Yeah, that's they have right.
They have an English gaffer as well, who was actually here in Hud last season. He was assistant to Brian Dean when Brian Dean went to Norway. Ian Birchnell, I think his name is. So, you know, it's a great opportunity. And this is what I'm saying. You know, maybe Ian Birchnell would never have got a chance to coach in the top league in England, for sure. Not Championship, for sure not. League One, I don't know. But now he's in the top league in Sweden. And, you know, making a career for himself, and fair play to him that he's took that route and he's had that kind of, you know, that mindset to, you know, to come to another country and adapt. And I hope that he goes on to achieve great things, because it just shows that, you know, there is people out there that have to go out and make a career for themselves through another route. And like I said, I say this to my missus all the time, I say to my parents all the time, I'm content with everything I've done. You know, I've not made millions from the game, but I've made a living. I've got a house. I've got health. I've got everything I've ever wanted, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And for me, I'm content with what I've done. And it just goes to show that you don't have to go and play in the Premier League to have made a career for yourself, and you don't have to. You know, you can play in League One, League Two. But like I said, I've stayed in the game till now. I'm 30 years old, and now, any time I play after this is a bonus for me. And I always said to my parents that I don't want to be one of those players that plays till 35, 36. So when I've had enough, I can step away and have my head held high and think, you know what, I've played in numerous countries. I've played this 200-300 games. I've done what I've set out to achieve. So, you know, whatever happens now, from now on, is a bonus to me.
Oh, of course. And let's be honest, I mean, your story should really influence a lot of Asian kids that want to get involved in the game. You know, as you said, the Premier League isn't the be-all and end-all of it. You still can make a career abroad. And I remember I was on BBC Radio Asia a few weeks ago, and I used you as an example of an Asian person who went abroad and plied their trade in numerous very successful leagues and has done so well for yourself. So, you know, as I said, you're kind of like the blueprint or the bar, so to speak. So,
but this is the thing, you know, and this is what I've been fighting for ages, you know. I don't, to be honest, I don't really do a lot of work for any Asian kind of you know, radio station or anything, because they don't appreciate, what I've learned is they don't appreciate people that, you know, if you're not in the limelight, if you're not playing in Man United, or if you're not, you know, playing in, you know, the Premier League Championship, they don't want nothing to do with you. And it's a shame, really, that kids don't get to see that there's players like me, Zesh Raymond, Harmeet Singh, you know, Etsas Hussein playing in Norway also, and many others that have made a career for themselves.
Mm.
And Asian kids don't get to see it, because the Asian media, the kind of people that you think would back us have nothing. You know, and we don't, you know, if you talk to me, Zesh, and players who have been, you know, and gone out and done something, we don't want any reward for it. We would just love to talk to people and tell them our story to help other kids. But they don't wanna, you know, give us that pedestal to be able to tell our stories, and it's a damn shame. And you know, when I talk to my parents about it, they just laugh, and because they understand that it's such a culture where they are so, like, they don't appreciate things, you know. If it's not big enough for them, then they don't appreciate it. And that's a stubborn part about culture, you know. And it's a damn shame, really, because me and Zesh and others have so many stories that could, you know, entice these young kids into making careers for themselves. But, you know, you ask a 10-year-old, do they know who I am? They wouldn't even know anything, you know. And that's a big shame, actually.
Yeah. You know, I know a few Asians that have done remarkably well in the game. You know, Manisha Taylor's a good friend of mine. She got an MBE, and, you know, she's doing really well at Queen's Park Rangers. You've got Samir Sawney that's got his own company, Motivate, and he was in Dubai for a while. And I just think that, while I agree with what you're saying, because it's a similar thing with the Greek community, you know, there are Greek radio stations that don't really want to give other people opportunities. They only have their own kind of people, if that makes sense. You know, not what you know, who you know. That's the kind of mentality that they have. And I've been a little bit frustrated about it. But at the same time, it's like, well, you know what, I couldn't care less, because I'm doing this for myself. I'm not doing for anyone else. And if they don't really want to help out, then that's their loss. I mean, I've spoken to the likes of yourself, and I've spoken to the likes of Yana Gobolos, that's now the assistant manager of the Greek national team. And, you know, they only want to know you when they want something. And I don't know if it's the same kind of thing with the Asian community. I can't really pass judgment, but that's the feeling that I get with the Greek community. But that's another story for another time again. But no, I completely empathise with you. I mean, Huma Shah is a lovely girl who sorted me out with the BBC gig. I'm more than happy to have a word with her. I'm sure she'll be listening in as well. She's a sweetheart, and I'm sure she'll love to talk to you about your career and all that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and I have this argument with so many people all the time, and people say, "Hey, have you heard about this kid coming through? Have you heard of this kid coming through? And I say the same thing, as harsh as it may be, and you're a football man yourself, so you will understand this, Colin. But I say, if you're not played over 20 games, it's not a career. And I'm sorry, but it is the reality of it. And, you know, I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about players like Zesh Raymond now. He's played 300, 400 games professionally. That's unbelievable, actually.
Yep.
I look up to him, you know, and he's a good friend of mine now. And I think, you know what? He's had a career and he's done well for himself. We could talk about kids, and it's great that they're coming through, and they have my utmost backing and support. But focus on the people that are out there playing and playing games week in, week out, and are making a career for themselves. Those are the people that the kids should talk to and know about. And it's, you know, you can see that I speak with passion about it, because I've been out of England now since the age of 19. Yeah, 19.
Yep.
I'm 29. That's 10 years. And not once have I had any support from my own cultural people.
Yeah.
And that's a damn shame. I do more for Kick It Out, people that are supporting racism and supporting ethnic minorities in football, but never from my own people, which is a damn shame. And it's something that I'm accustomed to now and I'm used to. So it is what it is, and I understand it. Because like we said, we come from backgrounds where everyone wants to outdo everyone. And if they're not getting something for out of it, then they don't want to help you. So it is what it is.
I didn't know you did work for Kick It Out. I mean, we're probably going to be name-dropping here. So you obviously know, like, Troy Townsend and Marcus Gann, and Osu Sankofa and all those, yeah.
Yeah, and what's Bobby Barnes and Anwar Uddin.
Anwar, yeah, he's a good lad, yeah.
Yeah, who else was it? Dan Lynch at the time. Kevin Coleman, is it? Kevin Coleman, maybe?
Wow,
yeah,
okay.
All these guys are great, great guys. And Piara, I tell you, a good guy, Piara Power. He used to work there. He doesn't know more. He does his own independent thing. Great guy, still keeps in contact. He's one of the only ethnic guys that keeps in contact with me from when I was 18. He still sends me like little messages here and there. Happy to see you done this, happy to see you do that. But the rest is just, you know, if it's not helping them, then they don't want to know. Mm-hmm. Which is a shame, really. Because like I say, you know, when you text me to do a show like this, I love it because I'm able to make a difference to some people, you know.
Yeah. The thing is, you've got a lot more stories than most successful footballers, if that makes sense. I mean, look, you could talk about Ballon d'Ors, you could talk about winning trophies, but it's kind of like a gagged lifestyle in that sense that they can't really speak their mind or say what's going on, really. Whereas people such as yourself, you're more open to it, not because you're not restricted, so to speak, but because of the fact that you've got so much behind you, you've done so much. That you can say, yeah, I've done this, I've done that, I've travelled here, I've travelled there, I've been to this league, that league, different cultures and whatnot. Whereas when you've got one or two players that have kind of stayed in the same league, they don't really have that many, I don't know, stories that people can relate to, I guess.
Yeah, mate. And it's, you know, you would be surprised at how many messages I get on LinkedIn from players who have played 300 games in England saying to me, hey, Nathan, will you be able to get me out here? Will you be able to get me out there?
Yep.
And this is how it's come now in England. And these players have... I wish I would have played that many games in England when I look back. But you can see that the contrast now of players wanting to go out abroad and experience things. Because, you know, when I go back to England, I love England. That's home to me. Where I'm born and bred is... I love the place. But nothing changes, mate, when I go back. And... you know, and I advise all young players now, go out and enjoy your experiences and enjoy your life because you have one life to live. The Norwegian kids now, I say to them, go and play in England, go and play in League Two, Conference, and go and see a different culture because, you know, these things are priceless in your life and you should, you know, want to do it.
You saw what happened at the weekend with Jack Grealish, with the Birmingham City fan that ran on the pitch. First of all, what did you make of that incident when you first saw it? Does that strike you with a bit of fear?
Yeah, I think so. I think in Norway that would never happen because everyone's so nice. But I was surprised actually. And what I was surprised about the most is, I remember I read a tweet. I can't remember who said it, but I'm thinking to myself when I was playing in England, and with the dressing room we had. Like we had to play. I played with like players like Troy Deeney.
Mm-hmm.
If he would have seen someone, you know, hit like a fan coming out, he would have knocked the guy's spark out.
Oh yeah.
So I'm thinking to myself like, I'm surprised of the reaction of, it's disgusting what happened, but I was expecting you know someone to just. I think back in the days, that guy would have got stomped out by one of the players.
Well, didn't Brian Clough punch a fan that ran on the pitch to celebrate a goal?
Yeah, mate. I was shocked, but now I think it's so much media attention around it. Players don't know how to react.
That's
the thing.
It's the fear of being sued, mate. That fan probably could have taken someone to court. I know Tammy Abraham was really ready to give the guy a kick in, but you know, last minute he kind of thought, better not. Because naturally, these footballers, they're going to be tarnished. You get what I'm saying? They're going to be vilified. It'd be, the guy shouldn't have run on the pitch, but the players should have reacted different. But there are children watching, but. So, you know, you're trying to defend your teammate. I mean, what if the guy had a knife? What if the guy had a tool on him? You just don't know. And this is the thing, like, Birmingham City, they came out with a statement saying they're going to revise their safety and all that kind of stuff. But listen, let's be honest. With the greatest respect to stewards, I've been to so many games, and it's very rare that you see a steward actually facing the crowd for the majority of the game. They're always looking over their shoulder, paying attention to what's going on the pitch and whatnot. So perhaps they need to bring in non-football fans to police games, so to speak. I don't know.
Yeah, mate, I was... Even the instance with Taverner, was it? With Rangers?
That's right, yeah. Hibs, sorry, wasn't it? Yeah, Hibs.
Yeah, mate. It's such a fine line now, but like I was watching the game is Super Sunday, and Souness and Carragher were talking about it, and Souness was saying, like, I don't think a point's due, it's not the club's fault, and to be fair, he's got a point. Like, you can't, like Carragher was saying, maybe a points deduction or et cetera, but I don't think it's, you know, it's not one idiot, two idiots, it's not a reflection of the players wanting to go out there and win. You can't deduct points from there. Their livelihoods, you know.
See, I'm going to interrupt you because this is a very, very interesting point that you've just made. Because, as I said, when I was on BBC Radio Asia the other week, we were talking about, you know, the Raheem Sterling incident with Chelsea and the incident at West Ham where they were singing racial hatred against Mo Salah, and obviously Millwall against Everton. Now, I suggested that the best way to really deal with this kind of thing is possibly to deduct teams' points. I'm talking like a 10-point deduction, because what it will do, it will obviously drop them down the table. It will prevent them from bringing in extra money from, say, Champions League. Say Chelsea, for example, if they miss out on Champions League by, I don't know, 9 points, and they got a 10-point deduction as a result of the Raheem Sterling incident, it obviously would hurt them in the pocket, which means that they'll be more vigilant or deal with racial incidents more than anything. But you're saying that you shouldn't punish the club. So, I don't know. Well, I mean, it's a difficult one to deal with, isn't it, really?
I think, for example, you know, for every homophobic chant, for every racist chant, if you got deducted 10 points, mate, you'd have 0 points. That's the problem. That's the issue here.
So because, is it society? Do you think it's society?
Yeah, mate. This is football. This has been going on for since football started. So, in my opinion, like, if every microphone around the stadium, if you mic'd up every single football fan that came into that stadium and deducted 10 points for every homophobic, racist, whatever derogatory thing they said, there'd be 10 points everywhere. You know what I mean? So where do you draw the line?
If it's one or two individuals, then the clubs can deal with that adequately. Do you get what I'm saying? But if it's 600-700, like Millwall, for example, and I'm using that as the best example because it was a majority that were doing it. It wasn't like at West Ham where it was two or three people, or Chelsea where it was just one or two. With the Millwall one, it was 600-700 people. Now, I'm saying disqualify them from the FA Cup because they got through.
You see, that's what I mean. And it's a massive decision for the football clubs to take, because and the FA, because, again, like you say, one person deducting 10 points from your whole team or 600. You know, it's a great debate because no one is right and wrong, you know. And that's what makes it kind of, everyone has a point and everyone has a reason. So it's a very, very, it'd be interesting to see what happens now. But like I say, you know, you when you're watching the games, even yesterday when I was watching the Blues game on Sky, the amount of people in the background I could see making a wanker sign, doing something. You know, how many people probably do a monkey sign? I'm guessing probably every fucking week someone does that. Yeah. So it's such a fight. Like, I'm from an ethnic minority. You know, I don't know how it was when I was playing in England. People don't probably even know. If my name was, like, you know, Singh or Abdul Rahim or something like that, then it might have been a bit different. But people probably never even knew that this kid was Indian, to be fair. So,
well, your surname does sound a bit South American, to be honest. So.
Yeah, and then people say that you don't really look Indian as well when you're on the pitch. So it's very hard to say. But, like, I remember playing Millwall away and it was fucking intimidating, man. Wow, that was the experience in itself. Just like, I remember we were either 1-0 up or we were 0-0, and they were throwing things, like, and it was 0-0 at half time, and they were just throwing stuff from the stands, and I was just like, wow, this is nuts.
Yeah. But you see, the thing is, I've always said that, you know, the powers that be can do something about it, but they probably choose not to because they're worried about being sued by the clubs. Go back to the whole Chelsea thing. If Chelsea miss out on Champions League because they've had a points deduction, no doubt that they'll bring in some super solicitor that knows loopholes that can basically end up suing the FA or suing UEFA, whoever it is. But at the same time, these authorities, they're not setting a precedent here. It's like with Rio Ferdinand, for example. They gave him an 8-month ban for missing a drugs test. Whatever he did, it doesn't matter. They set a precedent that, right, you miss a drugs ban, you're going to get a harsh final punishment. But then when you see like European teams like getting, you know, 26 grand fine or playing one game behind closed doors because of a incident of racism, that's not really a harsh punishment, is it? Because it's like, well, what's 30 grand to a club? I mean, they probably make what? That's probably like a tenth of what they make of on a match day or something.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the point, like what we just said, is, you know, if FIFA take a stance on this or FA or whatever, you know, and we go back to, like you said, deducting points or something. Again, like these places in Italy or Spain, mate, they're probably worse. They racially abuse their own fans, players. Sorry. So it's, you know, Poland and stuff like that. You know, if FIFA take a stance on this, then again, where do we draw the line? It's a real. It's a horror. I can't even believe we talk about this in 2019. To be honest, it's a joke.
Well, to be fair, a lot of things happened in 2019 that you know, you got people walking the streets, you know, with children in mind, so to speak, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's I think because of the way social media is, you're kind of more informed about certain things, whether it be fake news or facts. But yeah, everything's kind of like eye-opening, and you yourself, who's been travelling throughout the world, so to speak, you know, you've seen and heard a lot of things, but I'm sure you're quite alarmed to hear it's still going on, mate, back in the UK in comparison to everywhere else, because, you know, from what I understand, Canada is pretty laid back. Scandinavia is damn sure laid back. I mean, a friend of mine, Raj, he got together with a Danish girl and they got a child together, you know? So they're more open in certain parts of the world. But as you said, like in Italy, in Spain, in Eastern Europe especially, racism is rife at football. So yeah, you're right. Unless FIFA do something about it, it's going to continue. But as we said, you know, before, it's a society thing. It's something that, you know, you're not born a racist. It's the way that someone is, I use the term loosely, educated or drummed into their heads, you know? Yeah. So yeah, it's a really, really difficult subject, and even something to even come to some kind of agreement. We can't even agree as to what the punishment should be for it, you know? So
and it's just such a shame, like the society we live in. Like I grew up in a society where you guys are three or four idiots, but you know, I love like the multicultural side of life. You know, it's so sad, like it's that people still live like that. But we're fighting this every day, mate. I fight it every day. I walk on the street, so it is what it is. And I don't know how I would react. You know, if someone, you know, racially abused me on the pitch, I would take a 10-game ban to beat someone up, because they don't know what it's like to be racially abused, you know.
Yeah,
it's a dirty thing. Like, it's like the worst thing to hear, and it's the biggest way to get to somebody, and it's no place for it, and it's such a, I can't even bring words to it, because it's horrendous. And then to be punched as well on the pitch, like, and then score the winner. The guy needs what an unbelievable character.
Yeah, and he's still young as well. And this is the thing, it's a big character lesson for him. But he responded the most perfect way he could, and it was a great finish. So I know they stood off him and they kind of let him get that shot in. But even still, it was a very, very good strike. Very good strike.
And he's a Birmingham boy as well, so it's just weird. Like, imagine him walking in the city, like, and having to worry about some idiot, like, wanting to slap him in his head. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, but there are idiots everywhere you go, my friend, unfortunately. And,
that's true, mate.
But anyway, let's just hope that the guy's dealt with accordingly. But yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We've been going on for over an hour here. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, mate. It's the life of a footballer, mate. You just have so much free time. You don't know what to do sometimes.
When's the book out?
Exactly.
Fantastic. Well, mate, before I let you go, tell our listeners where they can grab you on Twitter, because you know, you mentioned that you're on it.
Yeah, N Sansara, capital letters. That's me. I don't really. To be fair, I used to use it a lot until we start losing games and you start getting smashed by fans. So I just go on there now to have a little peep on what people are saying and stuff. I don't really tweet much, but yeah, it's somewhere you can find me at, and yeah, just Facebook and etc. Like, I'm always happy to talk to people and you know, give a helping hand whoever needs it. So I have a lot of requests, actually. It's quite weird that I have a lot of requests for people doing bachelor projects. And they always, everyone always, it's weird to me because I think everyone, there's a lot of people doing bachelor projects on, you know, the lack of Asians in football. So yeah, a lot of people always contacting me about that. So yeah, I'm always happy to help, and like I say, I just wish everyone all the best, and yeah, enjoy life because you only have one.
Absolutely. Well, guys, hope you enjoyed this interview with Nissan Sansara. Mate, wish you well for the rest of the season, when it starts anyway. And yeah,
cheers, mate.
Fantastic. You can give us a follow on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. If you've got any questions, I'm more than happy to forward them on to Nissan. But obviously, he's just giving you his Twitter. So yeah, give him a follow on that. So that's it, guys. Until next time, take care.